Can everyone hear me?
Sound?
Great. Welcome.
So this is the start of our second program. We'll be finishing up with right view and moving on into right intention as a part of this. And it's really good to see all of you here. Hopefully you had a chance to meet with your mentors in the last couple of weeks, and they could answer most of your final questions. I'll give you a little bit of an opportunity after the set if you still have any questions. And part of the reason for that is there are some of you here who don't have mentors. So it gives them an opportunity, if they happen to have a question as well, that we can finish up. But the real intent is to move on into right intention and work that. So since we're here, we might as well go ahead and settle in a little bit, and before we get into the heart of what we're doing here. And because this is right intention, and part of right intention, one of the ones is loving kindness, I thought that I would do a little bit of meta this time as a starting point. In the right intention area is considered to be an antidote for ill will, which is one of the wrong intentions. It's also, in our practice, metta bhavana has been a meditation practice that in this tradition is widely used, widely taught, and it's used as a form of concentration. As such, it's an entry point into jhana practices and other types of things as well. So you'll probably have encountered it with other teachers, and if you haven't, I'm sure you will. So with the loving heart as background, with all that we attempt and all we encounter, will flow and work and for us much more easily. So I'd like all of you to go ahead and find a comfortable place to sit, a comfortable position. If you're comfortable on the chairs, that's great. If you want to move down to the cushions, that's fine. When we finish this, if you want to reverse that, you're perfectly happy to do that as well. In some of the other talks I did last week, I noted that the Eightfold Path sometimes gets reshuffled for various purposes. In the way we're working with it, it starts with right view and goes through so forth. In other practices, I noticed that sometimes it starts with the ethics first, the right speech, right action, so forth, and then moves from that on to these factors. With metta practice, you have a similar type of thing that can happen. Because we are trying to open the heart and we're trying to reach out, we need or use a target, a focus for that. In the strong practices, the bhavana practices, what happens is you usually start with yourself because that's the foundation for being able to reach out to the world. That's the foundation for really being able to offer it to anyone else in the world. And then you will move on to different people if you expand out from there. My experience with that is it's sometimes difficult for people who are coming into this practice to start with the self. We live in a culture, particularly the Western culture, that is very self-critical, very judgmental about the self. And there's a lot of people for whom initially extending that goodwill and so forth to the self is a little bit harder. So because part of what I'm trying to do here is simplify things, this is not going to be the place that you're going to be doing strong practice, but rather it's a place you're picking up the skills, you're picking up the knowledge to take in and develop your own practice. I'm going to go ahead and first ask you to start with what would normally be called a benefactor. That would be somebody or some being close to you. And don't pick the strongest person you can think of. It doesn't have to be somebody who's, you know, gone out and rescued you or anything else. It can be something very, very simple. If I look at myself, for example, I would probably choose my cat. I have a cat who loves to come and sit with me on the couch or on my recliner when I'm reading, and he's not trying to accomplish anything. He's just there. He likes the warmth of my body. And I like to be able to reach out and touch him and pet him, and it feels good. It relaxes me. It feels safe. It feels like a very comfortable thing to be doing. And because of that, over the years, we've developed this bond, and I have a great fondness for him without having to reach out and make a lot of effort to feel and express that particular set of feelings. So I would like you to start with somebody similar, somebody close to you, not somebody that generates a lot of mixed feelings of sometimes this person is somebody who's great to you and sometimes there's conflict, you know, parents, children sometimes are that way. But pick somebody a little bit softer, somebody who you generally have fondness for, generally feel is important in your life, and who it's fairly easy to feel good things towards and feel warmth towards without having to work at it too hard. So take a couple of moments here, and then what we'll do is I'll give a little bit more instructions. But think about, in your life, who would that be? What type of person would you find that would be around you for that? And just feel the warmth of that relationship. Now, once having found that person, I want you to think that you're breathing rather than being, as you, it might be with many people doing meditation on the breath, let it settle down from the mouth, from the that area, or the, into the area around the chest, around the heart. You're no longer really going to be breathing and working with the mind and other parts of the body. This is really breath through the heart. It's there to tap into the emotions, into feelings, into the depth of the heart, which in all cultures is attributed where these types of feelings come from. And then I want to give you four phrases that you can start working with, and you want to direct it towards this person or this being that you've chosen. And take into it the feelings that you found towards them, the warmth you found towards them, the worthiness in your life that you found towards them. And those first of those phrases is, may you be filled with loving kindness. So you're wishing that benefactor, that person, that they have the feeling of loving kindness as well towards the world, towards you, towards everything. May you be safe from internal and external dangers. So you wish them safety and a place to be and a life that is pleasant. May you be well in body and mind. May they be healthy. May they be untroubled. May their world be peaceful. And finally, may you be at ease and be happy. So again, may you be filled with loving kindness. May you be safe from inner and outer dangers. May you be well in body and mind. May you be at ease and happy. And let the images and feelings you have for your benefactor support your meditation. Continue to plant the seeds of loving kindness by repeating those phrases to yourself quietly and expressing your gratitude to that person for being part of your life. So again, I'm going to give you a few minutes here just to work with those phrases. Now I want you to try and expand that relationship out, now that you've established, or hopefully have established, a feeling of goodwill towards the other. That relationship with that person or being doesn't exist as a one-sided thing. It's not just you to them. In my earlier example, where I'm talking about quietly sitting with my cat, he's enjoying the warmth of me. He's enjoying the fact that I can pet him and scratch his ears, and I in turn am also gaining from that relationship the comfort, the safety, the calming qualities of it. So at all times, loving kindness like this is not a one-way street, it's a two-way street. So I'm going to let you bring yourself into this relationship now. And I want you to change then the and turn the phrases around towards yourself as well. So you can start working with phrases of, may I be filled with loving kindness. You probably are if you're establishing that relationship towards your benefactor, but realize that you are deeply there. May I be safe from inner and external dangers. May I be well in mind and body. May I be at ease and happy. As you develop loving kindness, this is the base, this is the place that it comes from. So you need to learn to not judge, but to recognize the perfection and beauty in yourself as well, as a place to let that loving kindness go into the world. So again, we'll just take a pause and have some quiet while you work with those phrases. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be safe from inner and outer dangers. May I be well in mind and body. And may I be at ease and happy. this point in the metta meditation, we would continue to extend our loving kindness out. We would find neutral people, people that we don't have any strong feelings towards, and bring it to them. And then beyond that, to people that we might have disagreements with or are uncomfortable around or even averse to when we're in their environment, and learn and try to develop loving kindness as what it really is, which is a feeling not based on what people directly are for you, but because they are part of the human family, because of the fact that they, like you, want happiness and meaningful lives, and therefore they deserve it, just as you deserve it. But I'm not going to do that here today, because this is a settling point of view, and rather than a meta meditation as a full. So I'm going to bring it to an end here. Okay, I think what we're going to do here is we're going to try and finish off the right view. Like I say, there may be some people who here don't have mentors and may have a question, or you may have some unfulfilled questions. G is a teacher here. I imagine that a number of you already know him. He's a teacher I have great respect for, and we feel it's important to try and bring in different points of view to these. So rather than Leslie and I trying to teach every one of them, we're going to try and switch off. I'm here this time. I think Leslie's at least was, if she's not still here, hanging around someplace. Yeah, she's back in the back. So she'll be here up front next time. I don't know if I'll be here next time. That's going to depend on my schedule. But we'll probably have somebody else with her to give you a point of view. So I'll let G say something if he wants. He's a long time, like I say, he's a long time teacher here, and I'm really happy that he was willing to come and do this with me.
Can you hear me okay? This thing's a little funny. Wants to be in my mouth, I think. Okay. My name is G. Schultz. I'm one of the community teachers here, and I'm really happy to be here. I've been involved in some of the past iterations of this program, and I've always gotten so much out of it, and it's always such a joy to be part of it.
Can you hear G?
Yes, I can hear G, but the hearing assistance device is not working.
Okay.
At least the one side so far. Right?
Yeah. Sometimes the battery is off on those. Or
I saw a light come on, so I don't think it was the battery.
Yeah, okay. Now can you hear?
No. Not through here.
Have you tried a couple of them already?
This is three.
Number three. Okay. Oh, sorry.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just
yeah.
No, that's okay. Unfortunately, I'm not that familiar with the whole audio system here, so I don't know.
It's been an ongoing.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Would it help to come up to bring it to?
Well, I've been sitting here in the front, so I'll hear what
okay.
I can
hear.
We'll try and talk loud too.
Talk loud, yeah, louder. Okay. Anyways, I'll just wrap. I'm just very happy that this is still going on. I'm not sure if this is the third or the fourth. The third. And I was telling Leslie, I always think that we may have saturated the market, you know, each time we run through. But you know, quite obviously, we have not. You know, so nice to see some familiar faces and a lot of people I don't know as well. So, yeah.
Okay. So as I said, we want to try and do is wrap up right view. Now, obviously, we won't cover everything in right view. A right view is one of those things that you will work with for years, and each time you reach a different level of understanding in it, what that also tends to do is open up a new, more subtle level below it, where you realize how it influences and impacts your practice. The other thing about right view is that it's not going to go away. Right view is one of those factors that pokes its head up with everything we will, every factor that we'll do here, because it is the understanding of where you go, where you're going. It's the orientation, and each time we want to talk about something, be it intention as today or speech as next time, and so forth, that orientation has to broaden and be filled in. So if you don't feel that you have everything in right view at your hands at this point, join the crowd. I don't either, and I've been working it for a long time. But that said, I do, if there are questions, pressing questions that people have, or we have people who don't have mentors and they had questions that came up to them that they felt they needed to have answered, I am willing to take a couple of minutes here before we move into right intention to try and address them, and G and I can do that. So if there's any questions, please speak up. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm not sure it's a question, so we'll see where it goes, but I appreciate some feedback at any rate. So one of the questions that we were looking at in right view was beliefs about liberation. And my primary motivation for following the path is liberation to benefit others. But I know that I have a lot of obstacles that I either pretend to have or actually do have. And the typical ones are sloth and not being able to concentrate and selfish and self-seeking and all those. I know those are obstacles to liberation. But in the kind of more in the right view category is that I believe in the idea of liberation, that like people are liberated in, you know, nirvana and the whole thing. And I don't know that what happened in my lifetime, so sometimes I'm just like, okay, well, maybe next lifetime. But then I get into this place of, you know, not faith. And I'm like, why am I doing this? I'm going to do the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Duos Meditation, and at the end, maybe I'll be a tiny bit happier, but I'm not going to be liberated. Why am I doing this? And so I just fall back into that kind of, why bother syndrome. And I see that as an obstacle in right view, but I also realize that right view is, we continue to work on that all the way through and to the end of the Eightfold Path as well. So I know I'm stuck here, but that's where I kind of came to as one of my biggest obstacles in this.
Okay, I understand that. I'll give you my point of view, and then I'll let G give you an extension of that and his feelings. I tend to be somewhat of a pragmatist in my practice. And when I talk about liberation, I realize there's a couple of different levels of liberation. There is the liberation to nirvana, which for me is also a distant goal. I'm away from it too. But I also take the term in its original meaning, which is freedom. And that freedom is the freedom from suffering. And that freedom comes when I am able to, in some sense, pause when things are happening and see what's happening and then make choices about how I go forward. Because as we've talked about karma, you both generate your karma and you inherit your karma. So what I do today, well, those choices I make today will determine what my life is going to be like next week, next year, and also the lives, to some extent, of those closest to me, and even, you know, at a more abstract level, those further from me. That's freedom, that's liberation, is that ability to make those choices. If I'm not seeing what's arising with me, if I'm not seeing the views that are coloring my world, if I don't know what's happening, I have no freedom. I'm driven totally by reaction to what's arising. There's no liberation there. So it's really necessary for me to learn to see what's coming up in my mind, see when I'm judging, see when I'm discriminating, see all of these things that are taking place, because it's only there I will find the freedom to have a different future for me and for my loved ones and for everyone else. So liberation at that level, whether I end up in nirvana or not, liberation at that level makes this practice worthwhile to me and important. G?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. what I'm hearing, it, you know, it's often called doubt. You know, it's one of the hindrances. So, you know, it's well known. It's, you know, one of the five that obstacles to the path. And your question, like, why am I doing that? That's a great question. You know, it's bringing up that question, and then that's worth exploring. Why are you doing this? Of course, I can't answer that for you, but I think that's a worthwhile inquiry. And then, as Jim was saying, that you may not reach, you know, full-on nirvana, absolute liberation, but you might reflect on your practice thus far, and you know, have you experienced some freedom from suffering? Are you more still or more calm? Are there some benefits of the practice that you're already experiencing?
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it'd be great to have, you know, the, you know, nirvana, you know, the big thing, but that is, it can take a while. We have a lot of conditioning to work through. So appreciate the small things, you know, as they arise. That's very important.
Are there any other questions people would like to raise before we go on? Okay. Well, then why don't we go on into right intention, recognizing that we have not covered everything in right view, but you'll have plenty of time as you go on. I'm going to address a little bit more of the background to it, and then later I'll let G address a little bit more of the practice of this. And in addressing the background to it, right intention is sometimes translated as right thought or skillful thought. And that's fine as long as you realize that the type of thought that they're talking about here is that motivation that causes you to act. It's the feelings that cause you to do things. It's the thoughts that cause you to do things. If you don't make that distinction, what ends up happening is you kind of blur right view with right intention. And so that's why I'm not as fond of the translation as right thought as I am of skillful intention or wise intention or right intention. Because it is really built on that... The meaning of it is really built on that idea that these are the motivations that cause our actions. It's sort of the bridge. The right view gives you the conceptual the orientation, the understanding of the way the world works and why it looks the way it does to you. And then after we get through and move on, we're going to go into right action. Right, the various things of right action, such as right speech, and the things that we do. And for the Buddha, that's the karmic process. What we do is what then creates the causes and conditions. And I was saying in my earlier comments, that then determines what our life is going to be like. And if you choose to do and you're motivated to do things that are skillful, that are beneficial, that are helpful to people, then you are tending to create a future in which you will experience things that are beneficial, and you are going to find things that where there is greater harmony and greater ease. If your motivations are to do things that tend towards violence, towards hurting other people, towards causing problems, if nothing else, you're going to make enemies, you're going to make people who want revenge and other things, and you're going to end up starting to create a world that's what you're going to inherit, and that's what you're going to go into. So the Buddha is trying to lay out that this is the process by which suffering arises and by the process by which we create our suffering, and the way then to take control of that, to live that, and eliminate a lot of that suffering is to start managing this whole process from what you want to what you're motivated to do to what you actually do. Now, in a lot of cases, we tend to think that our thoughts are not as important as what we actually do, that me thinking about doing a revenge is not as important as when I go out and actually try and get revenge. And that's true to some extent in a karmic sense, but it's not entirely true. I mean, the the Buddha's way of thinking about that, or at least his quote from that from the Dharmapada, was that all that we are is a result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain follows him as the wheel follows the foot of the ox that draws the carriage. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness follows him as a shadow that never leaves him. So our thoughts lead to our actions, and those actions create our karma. So, and in many cases, it's much easier to intervene, if you want to use that word, at the point which things are still thoughts. But you have to be, you know, to some extent aware that that type of thing is happening so that you can actually see it happening and you can intervene. So intention then is claiming this place as a second factor on the path, because it really is this bridge between our understanding of the world, our view of the world, and our actions, our ethics, our morality in the world. So that's why it ends up where it does. The Buddha was very interested in the types of intentions that cause suffering. And there are probably lots of different intentions that people could think of, you know, the intention to go downtown, the intention to do other things. But because he was so focused on the suffering and this type of thing, his interest was in those intentions that will lead either towards suffering or away from suffering. And so he focused on three specific types of intentions that he calls out in the suttas that discuss right intention. And the three types of wrong intention that he felt existed and caused suffering were craving and greed, that desire to take hold of things, to keep things, get things. Then the intention of ill will. With that, you have anger towards people, you have aversion towards people, discrimination towards people. Many other factors fall into that area. And the intention of harmful, of cruelty, of actually hurting other people or wanting to hurt other people, actually carrying out acts of revenge to punish the world for not being the way that you want it to be. And as a counter to those, then he put forth three right intentions, the three things that he felt were right intention. The first of those is the intention of renunciation, which I'll spend a little bit more in a minute because that's the one that's often most understood, misunderstood. The intention of non-ill will and the intention of harmlessness. Now, it's interesting, if you want to think about it, that when he defines the right intentions, the positive intentions, he in most cases defines it in terms of the negative of the wrong intentions. So that the wrong intention is ill will and the right intention is non-ill will. The wrong intention is cruelty and the right intention is non-cruelty or harmlessness or non-harming. Part of the reason he does that, I think, is it allows for a broader scope in thinking of the right intentions. A lot of times when you take the right intention and you try and put it into the positive context, it kind of narrows it down. Oftentimes loving kindness, for example, metta, is seen as the opposite of ill will, so that metta is the right intention and ill will is the negative of that. But there are many types of non-ill will that fall outside of metta. metta is a very good practice, and that's part of the reason we started with it today. But there are practices of generosity. There are practices of inclusiveness. There are practices of many things like that that go outside of just metta or loving kindness that fall within this category of non-ill will. And I don't think the Buddha wanted to narrow it down to just one of those types of things. Similarly, when you deal with cruelty, harmlessness has a number of other things. Again, things like non-discrimination and that type of thing that fall in that category of not doing other harm to others. There are also other things that, at least in the modern world, that we deal with, like with climate change and the use of resources and many other things that fall within our category of not doing harm, that are not necessarily fall into the traditional practices of non-harming, such as karuna, which is a compassion practice that's very similar to metta, and many people find great power in it. But the point is that they're in non-harming, there's a much wider breadth than just that. So I think that's part of the reason that it's phrased as the negative of the wrong intention. Now, renunciation, which I wanted to spend a little bit of time, which is nikama in Pali, is oftentimes the most difficult for us in our culture to understand. I think it's because of the fact that we're come out of a culture that is Christian, European, and we think back in our history and we look back to the monastics of our history, particularly things like cloistered nuns and the monasteries and stuff. And what we see is a great deal of vows of poverty, vows of giving up things like talking and other types of things that were greatly valued. And so it looks like almost like a poverty practice. And I also think that that gets compounded by the fact that even when we look back at the Buddhist tradition, we look back at the stories of the monks and the nuns there, and they fell under the rules of the Vinaya when they became renunciants, and they would give up for everything from money to their homes to their families to so forth. So again, it seemed very much like a poverty practice. And so when we think about renouncing things, we have a tendency of thinking in that terms of what we're giving up and what we don't want and to give up and what we would like to keep. And I don't think that was really quite the intention of what he was trying to do. In many cases, renouncing things is a very positive experience. It can sometimes be difficult. Things like the process of AA, where people are renouncing alcohol or people who renounce drugs, that can be a very difficult and thing to go through. But they're not doing it in order to attain a state of poverty. They're doing that to attain a state that is actually very positive. It allows them more control over their lives. It allows them to live richer lives. It allows them to escape the damage and destruction it does to themselves and the people around them. And I think that is a better place to focus on the practice of renunciation than to think of it as in terms of what it is you want that you have to give up. But like I say, I think that also you find that that is the way that it oftentimes gets interpreted here. So I think shortly we're going to go on into small groups and work. And what I would like to do is kind of work with that with you people. As we explained last time, small groups are optional. They're certainly of great value, so I highly encourage people to go into those types of situations, but if you don't want to participate, nobody's going to twist your arm. And it's important to remember that you're in control of whatever you say and what you bring into it. And just like I was saying in the metta thing earlier, that You don't necessarily want to pick the strongest thing that can come along. When you're dealing with the subjects that will come up in the small groups, you don't want to pick the strongest thing that you could imagine there either. This is not a, we don't have the time here to go into these things in the depth and in the breadth of time and everything else if they're really deep subjects that are of great significance to you. That's not saying that those aren't valuable processes, just like full meta-practice is a valuable process, but it's not for right here. So when I suggest these things, I would suggest you pick things that have less emotional charge to them when you work with them. That also makes it easier when you go into the small groups because you're dealing with stuff that has less emotional charge as well. What I kind of like to have you work with is this idea of renunciation. And in my case, for example, a level that I would be thinking about doing would be, I happen to be a person who likes coffee. It's part of my life. It's, you know, it's one of those things that I've kept going. And there have been times, particularly times like when I go to a retreat where most of the people switch over to tea and stuff, I keep my practice. Because in the morning, particularly in the early mornings, a lot of times I'll be the bell ringer and stuff and go around. And it's very nice for me, before I do that, to sit down with a nice warm cup of coffee and relax into it, wake up, do all of that. I think it's comforting for me. But at the same time, there is this thought in my mind that I'm in a place where most of the peers around me are going a different direction, and there's all this controversy whether this is a good thing or it's not a good thing to drink caffeine and all of this. So there is at times in my mind that has risen this idea of maybe I should give it up, maybe it's a renunciation thing. Now the content of that is not so important to me, but I think it's important when you experience that type of thing that you explore what arises in you. Because if you explore when it arises in you, what you find is it goes a couple of different directions. Sometimes that renunciation takes the form of shoulds. I should give this up. I should eat better for better health. I should treat these people nicer because that shows that I'm a nice person. So all this should stuff arises, and that is not the process of renunciation. Renunciation, when it comes from the heart. It's because you realize the benefits to you and yourself and to other people around you that what you're giving up is something that is not beneficial. It's something that brings, that leads to suffering, it leads to harm. It's not done because of all of these shoulds that we all feel. So what I, and then, let's see. And then the other thing you'll notice when you start thinking about renouncing something that you happen to like, but have mixed feelings about, is the resistance. The arguments that, oh, I've given up all these other things, this is my last vice, if it is a vice, you know, I get to keep that. That's mine. You know, so all of these types of things will also rise up in your mind when you have to do this. And as I also said last week when we go into these small groups, when you're in these groups, the listener really should be spending at least half their time focused internally on themselves rather than spending a lot of time listening to the talker. You don't want to ignore them, but that's not the point of this. What the content of what they're saying, hopefully is superficial, somewhat superficial to them, but and therefore can be somewhat superficial to you. But those things that rise up in you in reaction to it are important. And also when you're the speaker, the same thing. You can focus on the words that are coming out that you're talking about and the experiences you're talking about, but equally and perhaps more importantly is what are those words doing to you? Can you feel these resistances? Can you feel these shoulds in dealing with this? Because it's in this noticing, it's in this realization that this is taking place. This is sati, and this is sati sampajanya. Sati is to be in the moment and to know what's going on. Sati sampajanya is usually translated as clear comprehension, and that's that you really understand what the experience is like, that you really understand these things that are arising. And as I was pointing out earlier, it's by being aware of those things and being aware of those experiences that you start to be able to make choices and you start to have freedom. So what I would like to do is go ahead and we're going to do it like we did last time. We'll break up into groups, then I'll give you about 3 minutes to think about this topic of finding something that you've experienced thinking about renouncing in the past, but you happen to like. So, and then we'll go around and let everyone do, we'll break up into groups of three or four, preferably three. We'll let everybody but go around and have about 3 minutes to talk about from their point of view, and the other people can go ahead and listen and split their time between what's being said and what they're experiencing. And then after that, we'll come back, and if there are any comments, we'll deal with those as too. And then we'll have one at the end. So if you end up in a group of four, that's fine. You can use all that time. If you end up in groups of threes, we'll have a final period at the end in which you can just sort of talk back and forth. So let's go ahead, Ryan. We'll start with you with one, and just number off. And let's see, how many people do we have here? So why don't we come back to the large group, and if there's any comments, we'll pick those up. And then after that, we'll have a break so people can use the restrooms and stretch their legs and whatever they want. So for my benefit, how was that for you? Did you find it interesting, worthwhile? Did it bring up anything? We won't spend a lot of time and then we'll take a break, but yeah.
I wanted to say something else about the listening and the talking time. I picked up the listening last month about really focusing on your reaction and your body. Oh my God, I think that has been so enlightening for me personally. I've brought it into my life. And I'm reminded again, for 2 weeks, it was like, I was really like, oh yeah. And for me, it sort of just takes the pressure off of any sort of thing, any interaction with somebody, you know. Listening, hearing, but and caring, but there's this level of freedom for me that comes with that. Just listening to other people in my group, I just feel like we're all dealing with the same resistance. You know, flavors are different and habits of mind are a little different or whatever, but it really helps to hear that reflected back. That's all.
Okay. Yeah, and I would say that recognition of commonality is an important driver in things like loving kindness and compassion too, because it helps you to realize that the person you're talking to is pretty much like yourself, with the same needs, same desires, same.
The what really touched me was the level of criticism, self-criticism.
Mm-hmm.
I really felt compassion when people were talking. That's a shift for me.
Mm-hmm.
That means I'm not feeling compassion for myself.
Good. Good. Yeah. I wanted to add to that part about feeling, not necessarily being in the content or, you know, in the headspace, but what's going on in the body. I think that's a great way to work with right intention, to help you feel what's going on. And I'll talk about that a little in the second half here, but I think that's a key to practicing right intention, is to know what's happening, you know, to kind of go in deep versus just being caught up in the thinking process.
Yeah. Does anyone else have any comments or anything they'd like to add?
Yeah.
I found that distinction between a should kind of
mm-hmm.
intention and a renunciation just coming from a recognition of its benefit to you really helpful.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Something that came up in our group was, does renunciation have to feel negative? Does it have to bring up all of these things? And I suppose it's a lot less interesting to talk about in these groups unless you're choosing something. But a few of us said that, like, well, there are things we're renouncing that we're aware that feels good. But so I'm going to ask about that.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was alluding to when I was talking about the renunciation, and unfortunately has all these connotations that came out of our monastic, poverty-oriented history. And it doesn't. Yeah, I agree with you. It doesn't have to be that way.
I'll say more about that too. But other words for renunciation are simplicity, generosity, letting go. There's, for me, these are more positive connotations. It's kind of lightening up our load, you know, putting things down.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
I just have one thing to say, that just thank you all for, you know, when we're sharing our stories, it's just fabulous. It's so powerful. So thank you all.
Okay, well, let's take a break then, about a 10-minute break, and you can stretch your legs, go to the bathroom, whatever, get something to drink, whatever, and then we'll come back and I will let G run things in the after that. Thank you very much.
Am I on? Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody. I think we're all here. And again, I'm G Schultz, and I will be picking up the second half of our session. And what I'd like to talk about is again about how we can bring this factor of right intention or right thought, how we can bring that into our lives, how we can work with this so that it's not like a nice concept, a nice idea, but it's actually something that we can incorporate in our lives and that will actually hopefully have some benefit for us in how we live, how we relate. So some of the things I'll say will be similar to what Jim has said. There'll be some overlap, but hopefully it will be either a refresher or just a little different angle on the subject. I'll just start out. I'm kind of going to work with right thoughts, which is another way of talking about right intention. And the reason is the thoughts, our thoughts are very powerful. They really matter. They make a difference. And I remember for myself when I was a young person, I actually used to think that it didn't matter what I thought, that whatever's going on in my head, you know, people can't read my mind, and it's not showing. So, you know, I could think whatever I want and, like, get away with it. but, you know, it doesn't really work that way. Our thoughts are very, very powerful. They set, they incline our mind. either towards, you know, a heart of goodwill, of ease, of friendliness, or they can incline our mind to a heart that is hostile, that is judgmental, critical. And I think all of us, you can see that in ourselves, where maybe we have a critical mind, a judging mind, a mind that doesn't like. If we let that type of mind have full rein, it really makes a difference in how we feel about things, how we feel about other people. So it really does matter what you think about. And these thoughts, they do lead to our actions and to what we say, what we speak. I was laughing with Jim a little bit because the quote he had, it's from the Dhammapada, which is the quote I was going to use as well. But my version is slightly different, and I think it's such a wonderful saying that it's worth saying it again. And the Dhammapada is a collection of sort of pithy teachings, and it's actually the very first two verses of the Dhammapada that I'm going to read to you. And the version I have here is slightly different, so it'll sound familiar, but the wording is just a little bit different. All states of being are determined by mind. It is mind that leads the way. Just as the wheel of the ox cart follows the hoof print of the animal that draws it, so suffering will surely follow when we speak or act impulsively from an impure state of mind. All states of being are determined by mind. It is mind that leads the way. As surely as our shadow never leaves us, so well-being will follow when we speak or act with a pure state of mind. So I love that because it's talking about our mind. It creates our world. And in fact, it's often said that we don't see the world, we see our minds. You know, that's how we know the world, is through our minds. So it really makes a difference what's going on in here and how we think, the kind of thoughts we encourage and the kind of thoughts that maybe we don't feed, don't allow to just keep going. So this is where our mindfulness practice comes in, where we notice that voice. I think for many of us, it's a little bit of an awakening to know that we do have this voice going on. And I heard somebody say, if you're wondering what I'm talking about, that's the voice right there talking, yeah, that little voice that reacts to everything. So with mindfulness, we become more aware of this voice, these thoughts. And as we were, one of the comments about that breakout session is that if we pay attention, especially to the feeling of these thoughts, for example, maybe you're driving and there's somebody who cuts you off and your thoughts go like, you know, that blah, 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 and why can't they see what's going on, and that's dangerous. So that's the content, all these words. But underneath that, your heart's racing, you're clenched, you're feeling angry. And so with mindfulness, we start to pay attention to how this is affecting us. And if we really see clearly, that clear comprehension that Jim was talking about, we see that this is suffering, where our thoughts are creating suffering. Sometimes we think that, you know, we're just reacting, that this is how it is, and, you know, that bad driver or that unthoughtful person, that they make me feel this way or did something to me. But the reality is that it is our response. We have a choice as to how we respond to the world, as to how we meet the world, as it were. We don't have to come at it a certain way. We don't have to be aggressive. We don't have to defend ourselves. We can be more open. So as Jim said, there's the Buddha named three ways of thinking that cause suffering. These are thoughts of ill will, thoughts of greed or lust, thoughts of hostility. And the Buddha is very clear that if we engage in this kind of thinking, if we allow our minds to just go on with, you know, harmful thoughts, with, you know, greedy thoughts, wanting thoughts, lustful thoughts, or thoughts of, you know, just wishing poorly for others, there will be suffering. It's just, they're conjoined. You know, it's just one follows the other, like the wheel that follows the ox. They go together, just like that. So the right intention, the Buddha came up with right intention as a way to counter these three poisons or defilements. I liked what Jim said, how the Buddha would typically say, okay, you want non-harming, non-ill will, non-greed or non-lust, which can baffle our mind a little bit. What exactly is that? But it does, you know, make it open as to what exactly that could be, what that could look like. So as I mentioned, like for renunciation, some of the ways that renunciation, one, it could be renouncing, you know, I'm not going to have coffee, I'm not going to use money, I'm not going to eat after midday. You know, these are some monastic vows. But it could also, as I mentioned, be just living a simpler life, you know, doing without all the extra stuff that we have. And the nice thing about that is a simple life gives one ease. You're not so caught up in, you know, trying to keep everything going and with a lot of clutter in your life. So I think simplicity is a beautiful way to think about renunciation. Letting things go, just doing without. Do I really need this? You know, do I have enough with what I have already? And, you know, I think all of us have experienced that we sometimes become the slave to all our possessions, to all the stuff we have. You know, we end up taking care of them, being ruled by them. It's almost like we don't have our lives. We're the servant to the stuff. Other ways to think about renunciation, generosity. It's a beautiful way to let go. And I think probably everyone here knows that when you're generous, how that feels in your heart, when you come from a truly generous place. It's not a tit for tat. I won't use a Latin version because that's been getting a lot of play. but when you truly give something out of the kindness of your heart, it's quite wonderful feeling. In fact, the Buddha said that, you know, you can enjoy generosity three ways. The thinking of doing it brings up a good feeling that, oh, I'm going to do this for somebody. The actual act of doing it feels good. And then later you can reflect on that. You know, oh, that felt really nice. You know, I gave this thing to somebody or helped somebody, and you can see them smile and just, you know. So generosity, it's really being generous to yourself as well. You know, it's not like it's a one-way street. So also unburdening, you know, just putting our burden down, just letting go of things. That's all renunciation, ways to look at it. And then goodwill and harmlessness. None ill will can be translated as goodwill or loving kindness. And then none harming could be harmlessness or often compassion. And if we think of it in terms of loving kindness and compassion, those are two of the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes of the heart. The other two are mudita, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So I love that because they are heart practices. You know, loving kindness clearly is about opening our heart both to ourselves and to others. You know, appreciate the people that we love already, that we already have good feelings for, and just, you know, just kind of basking in that, really enjoying that. And then working to extend that out to people that maybe we're not so prone to do that with. You know, people that, you know, maybe aren't neutral or even difficult. And just see how that feels. You know, it's a training. And, you know, it comes from a place of knowing that just like us, others want to be happy and want to be safe. And so we wish that for others. And I think, I believe that if other people were happy and safe and healthy, had ease, they probably would act differently, you know, if they had that going for themselves. So I'll talk a little bit about working with right intention. The first thing, I believe, is to, again, to recognize when we're getting caught up in unwholesome thoughts. So that's where it's really helpful to know that thoughts of ill will and thoughts of greed and hostility, that these are unwholesome, and to recognize it when it's happening. And as I mentioned, one of the, I think, great ways to recognize it is to feel it in your body. How does this feel when you're, you know, really want something bad? How does that feel? Or when you really are angry with somebody, how does that feel? And I think if you really sit with that, you can see that it is suffering, you know, for yourself, and then it's going out in the world too, you know, it's the other people, you know, feel that. So it's creating a field of suffering. I think it's helpful to just think, am I adding suffering to the world, or am I maybe lessening suffering? And I love the idea that even if it's just a little bit, if I can lessen the amount of suffering in the world, that feels good, you know. It's to kind of bring it down a notch, right? So recognizing our unwholesome thoughts when they come up, that's mindfulness, and, you know, feeling into it. And then when we do that, we can, it's often is helpful if we might drop the content, you know, the storyline, as it were. Sometimes our minds can get just tripped up, well, I'm right, and they did this, and, you know, they shouldn't have, and I'm going to, and blah, blah, blah. But if we just drop into the feeling place, then it changes it a little bit. It becomes more workable because we're not caught up in trying to figure this thing out. So that's where pausing and stopping are helpful, just sitting with it instead of, you know, spinning those wheels, because it just goes round and round, and usually gets worse. And then the last thing is to, where we can possibly substitute wholesome thoughts for the unwholesome. So if we're feeling a lot of anger, possibly we can bring metta, loving kindness, into it. And again, I'm going to, I was talking to someone about this during the break, but I'm going to bring driving into this, because I find for myself, driving is a great practice opportunity for dealing with all kinds of unwholesome states of mind, right? It's so, that can be its own practice.
Yes.
So, for example, you know, anger. You're angry at somebody, and, you know, maybe you're cussing and just, you know, wishing them, you know, maybe wishing them something bad will happen to them. But you can do it the other way around. You can, like, oh, I wonder how that person is doing, if they're okay. You know, maybe they're having a hard day, or maybe they're just really kind of wound tight and this is just how they are in the world. So then I can start to feel a little compassion for that person, that they're caught up in, you know, some patterns that maybe are not so helpful. Not helpful to me as a another driver on the road by them, but how it must feel for them as well. And then perhaps from there, I can even go into metta, like, oh, may you be happy, you know, may you have ease, may you be safe, you know, These are all great things for drivers, you know. You know, ease, be safe, you're happy, smile, you know. It's just, you know, better for me, better for others, right? Okay, yeah, I'm just trying to figure out my time here. So, there's things, I was talking to Patty, there's things that you can do to actually kind of help create a field. For myself, knowing that driving is a challenge for me around mind states, if before I even start in the car, but before I go, I just sit maybe for 3 breaths, just to breathe in, breathe out, you know, maybe holding the wheel of the car, feeling it in my hands, settling into my seat, closing my eyes. I'm not moving at this point, just closing my eyes. And just feel my body in the car. And then I start to feel a sense of ease. And I think, oh, this is nice. This is how I like to drive, is a sense of ease versus the, you know, this and the kind of leaning. And so it's a nice way to start like that. And then as I go, I can think, how can I be a safe driver? How can I be somebody who makes the world safer, more pleasant for people? So giving other drivers plenty of room. At a 4-way stop, maybe I give, if it was that tie, like, oh, you go ahead, you know, right? Instead of being like, I was there just that much, you know, more ahead of you. And then with pedestrians, it's really fun because sometimes there's, you know, especially when you're in a hurry, right? You're like, oh, I won't hit them, you know. they see me. But instead, like, no, you know, like stop, you know, and stop way back, you know, clearly, you know, stop. And then maybe even, you know, signal to them. And I found almost more times than not that when I do that, you know, they'll wave. There's this, like, little connection that I have with them. And so it really changes the whole feel of driving, you know, becomes this pleasant. I feel like a little bodhisattva driving my metamobile, you know, just like radiating kindness to the world, you know, in front of me, the sides of me, versus being in a hurry, trying to get around this guy and, you know, that so-and-so jerk. And right? It's just a very different way of being in the world. So that's an example of how we can bring, I think, right intention into our practice, into the world. And so what I'm going to ask you to do is think for yourself about places in your life where maybe you have some habitual thoughts or thinking patterns, stories that are not so wholesome or skillful, that you know maybe create some suffering. It could be ways that you think about maybe a family member, you know, how you have this story about them, and, you know, they always do this, they always say this thing, or and that story, you know, we keep feeding it, and it just puts them in this box. This is how they are. I would put that in the category of not a very helpful thinking pattern, because it creates suffering, you know, for yourself, how you feel about that person, and the relationship you have together. And how we criticize ourselves, you know, like, oh, I should have done better, or why can't I ever get it together? You know, whatever our story is that might be critical of how we do things or how we can't do things, that's not so helpful either, you know. So if we can start to identify some of these stories, you know, see them, see the suffering, then we can start working with them and maybe changing our reaction, you know, maybe bringing in compassion, loving kindness to our storyline. So, I think, let's see, did we number first and then give people time to?
Yes, that's what we did.
Okay. So I'm going to have you number differently so that you'll, I think, end up with different people. And so what I'd like to suggest is that we do 1, 2, 3, and that's a group. 1, 2, 3, that's a group. So you're going to be more grouped with your neighbors, right? So why don't we, I guess, start here.
1, 2, 3.
Okay, so that's one group, right? So see your group.
One.
Two.
Three.
That's a group.
One.
Two.
Who wants to be part of this group? Three, back there. All right, and then here?
One.
Two. Three.
There's a group.
One.
Two.
Three.
All right, there's a group.
One.
Three.
Three.
One.
Two.
Three. Okay, y'all got each other?
One. Two. Three.
All right, so those are your groups. So why don't you go ahead and assemble together, please?
Yeah, what I did last time was broke it up into 3-minute segments, so I gave 3 minutes to think about it, and then 3 minutes for each of the people, and 3 minutes afterwards. So
I
don't know what it okay. to be. Three by 15 minutes or something like that. I don't know.
Is that on? I didn't know if my microphone was on. That's funny. Maybe I turned it up automatically. Okay. I think I'm going to give them
so
2 minutes
to
talk
yeah.
or to think, and then... It goes quick.
Yeah. It does. It does.
It seems longer when I'm listening, but when I'm talking, it's like, wow.
I always have too much. I'd rather be psychologically, I'd rather have too much than too little.
Yeah. Okay. Is everybody settled in your group? All right. Okay. Let's take 2 minutes of silence and. And what I'd like you to do is think about, well, I'll give you both of the questions here. What are the thoughts, stories, habitual thinking patterns, mind states that lead to suffering, lead to ill will, tension, stress? So what are your stories? So what are your typical habits of mind that lead to suffering? Of course, you don't have to do all of them, but see if there's one that is prominent and that you'd feel comfortable sharing with the group. And then the second part of that will be what practices of right intention or right thought do you use or could you use that would counter these unwholesome thoughts? That would lead to more happiness and kindness and ease. So does that make sense? Any questions about these questions? Okay. So yeah, see what thoughts you have that aren't so helpful, and then what practices do you have or could you maybe employ, maybe inspired to use to work with these difficult mind states, okay? So I'm going to give you a couple minutes just to sit in silence and think about that. So I'd like to take a few minutes just to see if people have any comments about this exercise or any questions. Yes.
Question. So when you're experiencing, when you have your story, and part of that story is difficult and taps into a lot of emotions, and you want to try to change that, be mindful, try to change that into more positive goodwill or ease or compassion, any of that. When you do that, how much of it is authentic and how much of it is willing that you're going to make this change?
Maybe both. Yeah, there is a little bit of a faking it till you make it piece. You know, like wishing goodwill for somebody that you really don't like may not feel very authentic. But you might try it anyways. Sometimes what it does is it brings up your aversion even more. You know, like, oh, I really don't like them. But, you know, it helps you work through that, right? It helps you to kind of see more clearly what you're harboring, what you're feeling in there. And some stories, some situations are more intractable. You know, they take time, maybe a whole lifetime to work with. So be very kind and patient with yourself in doing this practice. It's definitely worthwhile to work with these very difficult situations, but be sure to work on things that aren't like the hardest thing. And that will give you some good practice and hopefully will give you opportunities to have a positive effect, you know, so you can see how this can work. But the more difficult ones may take time, and so patience and self-compassion are really important to be with that practice.
Yeah, thank you. And I have a part two.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Sorry.
Part two is so then when you find you're in that situation, you gave what if you really don't like the person, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But is it helpful to, what if it's that you don't like the feeling? So if you identify the feeling, and if you don't like the feeling, mm-hmm. is it the feeling that you could work to change? Or work on the feeling rather than the story?
I think the feeling is probably where the work is, more than the story. The feeling. So unpleasant, right? This is feeling tones. You know, this is unpleasant. And you know, we're wired not to want to be with unpleasant. We want to push that away. But part of our practice is to really know what that is and to be with it as much as we can, to know our suffering, because unpleasant is suffering, right? So one, it increases our capacity to be with things we don't like, to be with our discomfort, instead of just trying to go to happy or to distraction or to numbing out, which are, you know, are more typical or common ways of dealing with unpleasant. Just to hang with it is a little counterintuitive, but it's kind of what the Buddha recommended, is to be with it. And my experience, the more I can be with it, this feeling, it's not solid. I'm so sorry. I don't know what's going on here. Maybe if I hold. How's this? Okay. No? Okay, good for some, not for some, but the more ability I have to be with those really difficult feelings, the more workable they become. I start to see that they're not fixed, they're not permanent, may feel that way, but over time, we give them room and breath, they start to unfold, they start to move and transform. We have to be very patient. We can't say, okay, I'm going to be with it for 5 minutes and it better be, you know, something different. You know, it's going to be on its own time. But the more we can just allow it to be, the more it can begin to shift to something. Yeah. Do you have anything on that?
I don't really have much to add because I basically agree with him. But I was talking to someone earlier about this type of thing, about forcing it and that type of thing. And what I was pointed out is part of the reason that in these exercises and stuff, that when we've been doing them, I keep recommending that you start with something that's not the ultimate, not the thing, is because this is a gradual training process. This is a path. It's going to hopefully last a lifetime. I mean, you'll start where you are and you'll go as far as you can. Some people go quite a ways and some people won't go so far. But this is really a lifestyle, and it is something that builds up over time. And as I was pointing out, there is an analogy to working out with weights and so forth. You don't start out with a 300-pound barbell when you first go to start doing it. You start out with something simpler, and you build up the strength, and it goes from there. And this is absolutely no different. It's a gradual training process. So you can't expect to handle the worst one first, and start where you can and move forward. The value of it is, as you, the further you go, the more gentle things become, because the more you've learned to handle, even if there's going to be that one out there still that's just going to push your buttons and you're just going to have to walk away from, or see yourself react in ways you would really rather not be reacting. So, but be gentle with yourself, because that's the way we all are, and you know, it's a good way to live.
So I'd like to open it up to, if there's any questions about our day, right intention, please.
Oh, I was just going to comment on how difficult it has been for me to pause. It's not culturally normal in a conversation to pause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it leaves things open, and people feel like they need to fill that in. And the one thing I have noticed about coming here and all the different speakers that we've heard from is they're slow and intentional. And I love that. But working out in the real world is not always something you can use. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So I'm struggling with that a little bit. I need to do it more than anyone because I'm very reactive.
Mm.
So, you know, it's something that I've kind of taken on. I need to start practicing more. But it leaves the person on the other side of the conversation a little bit lost.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pausing, especially in a conversation, that can be difficult. Yeah, I'm sort of going out. I have a relative where my pauses are there opening to say something.
Exactly.
I was like, wait, I wasn't done. I was just pausing.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and it's. But what I'm hearing is that for yourself, there's that inclination to keep going, and maybe you could experiment with that in your conversations. If you pause, it might take people a little while to get that. They know you a certain way, and now you're pausing, they may think you're done, but might experiment with that. And it's another reason that we encourage you to be embodied with your conversation, not to be all in your head and all in your thoughts, because that's one way to be in touch with what's going on. If you have a sense of your body, the energy, the feeling of this conversation, you know, being with this person. So it's almost like tracking in two ways, but gradually, you know, bringing more of this, more of that, the gut feeling in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We talked about anger and then started looking at jealousy a little bit and stopped as if that's different. But what I think I'm understanding is there are these human emotions that we all have, whatever we call them. Frustration, irritation, anger, jealousy, you know, sadness, whatever. And we have these triggers, and if we have an intention, and I don't know what that is, but we were looking for practices, and I'm wondering if the practice is part of the training so that we can be more present, or if that's too strategic, and if there's just something larger. You know, like just live in metta, just stay in metta no matter what shows up. Mm. Offer yourself metta, offer the other metta. I'm just wondering what you think about that, to kind of bring it together, so it's not like we have all these fragmented reactions and pieces. It just seems like we are these whole beings and, as humans, and we're all humans in this experience. And
well,
then jealousy.
The jealousy part. I think the thing for myself that helps bring it together is mindfulness practice, just to be mindful of what is happening, to see clearly. And because if we don't, if we're not aware of what's going on, you know, we could be jealous and not even aware that it's jealousy, you know, that's why you're feeling so strongly. So the mindfulness will help us to be aware of what is happening, and then hopefully with that awareness, maybe there's a tool or a practice that will emerge to meet that situation.
Well, given that the awareness is there, oh, there's jealousy again.
I see it.
What's a response?
Well, you could, like, metta and compassion for yourself, because jealousy is really hard. You know, it's kind of wired in. That's, I know for myself, that's what I try to do, because I suffer when I'm jealous, for sure. And I also try to be very careful about my words and my actions, because if I'm coming from a jealous place, they're usually not very good. You know, they're usually unskillful. But often just kind of feeling for myself, because it's suffering. I think it's an afflictive emotion, and we all have it. It's, you know, it's kind of in our DNA, I think. But we can just be kind to ourselves when we're suffering that way, and then hopefully respond with a more wholesome way, you know, as we get better with our good intentions and, you know, bringing our heart in. But yeah, unfortunately there's not like a silver bullet or one thing that just like does it all. It's a practice. Do you have anything?
Yeah, I want to add a little bit to that, and it really kind of addresses this point you're making about strategic versus the overall. The strategic is because you're on this path trying to change, you're trying to get away from the suffering. Where the overall comes in for me is it gives me the context. The overall understanding of this is the human condition, and that even in spite of all these things, that condition is actually perfect. It is what has evolved in this world, and inherently there's nothing wrong with it, is, I think, important. And understanding that what you want to do are these larger goals of loving kindness for everyone, compassion, that these are goals. They may be impossible goals in the sense that most people can't manifest them, but by holding to those and building up that this is really the world you want to live in, what it does is that when you come into that moment where things are happening so fast, and everything tends to be reactive, you're also in a time and a place where you don't really have the time to think it through, you don't always have time to be mindful and so forth, but sometimes in that place you have enough of a pause to say, what would I want to do here based on these larger goals that I've set for my life? Okay, it may not mean that in the moment you're going to be perfectly mindful, make the perfect decision, everything else, but at least you have a basis in that moment of changing from a reactivity that you know doesn't lead to those larger goals you decided are the way you want to live, to trying at least to choose paths that will take you to them. So by doing that, they set an overall context in which this strategic moves are operating. They give you that fallback position to go to when you don't have enough control or the time doesn't give you enough possibility to really make those refined choices. You just sort of have to go with it. How I go with it? I go with it based on these things that I really believe in, because they suit the way I want to live in the world and I want the world to be. Mm. So.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We're at 4 o'clock already.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you want to do some metta or something? I mean, some dedication to merit or anything?
Yeah. So we're at 4 o'clock. It's our closing time. So we'll close. I'd like to close with a dedication of merit. And so please just find a comfortable posture. And come into your body. the breathing body. Just allow whatever feelings from the day, whatever is going on with you in this moment, just allow it to be there, allow it to be known. And you might just recollect or reflect on the goodness of this time together, of our practice, listening and sharing the Dharma, sitting, thinking about right intention, goodwill, compassion, renunciation. And just know this is wholesome, this is good. And also that this is a practice that we do not just for ourselves and not just for those closest to us, the loved ones in our lives, but it's a practice for all beings. And in fact, it does spread, it does radiate, it does affect the world. And so may any goodness, any merit that's been accrued by our time together, may it go out into the world for the benefit of all beings, numberless beings, that all beings may be free from suffering, that all beings may be in peace, and that all beings may be happy without one being left behind.
Sunday in December. I'm not sure I know which date that was.
And it'll be
8th.
Okay, so December 8th, and it'll be on
Right Speech. And then Leslie will be leading that one, and she'll have a guest teacher for that.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.